Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Simon Winder talking about Lovaryngia.
Well, so here we go into East Africa in the 19th century. What I want to do this afternoon is to open up this extraordinary world of East and Central Africa in the second half of that century and through the life of this unusual character, Tipu Tip, a person who inspires mixed emotions in the modern historian or reader, since he was often ruthless, frequently violent, and his life took him into activities which we now abhor: ivory trading, slave trading, and imperialism. Yet all his European interlocutors report how they enjoyed his conversation, his humour, and his wide interest in world affairs. This afternoon we shall, I think, find him an engaging travelling companion through this area and a useful prism through which to look at this important historical period. The themes which we'll look at are those in the subtitle of the book, which I hope this lecture will inspire you to read. Ivory, because this was the high-value product which motivated the Arabs in the expansion of their trade through Central Africa. Slavery, another high-value traded resource in which also the Arabs were the principal traders. And discovery, because the European explorers, coming before the colonizers, were for some decades the main source of knowledge in Europe and North America about Central and East Africa. And the scramble, that extraordinarily rapid process in which European states absorbed African territories in a frenzied acquisition of empire in the last two decades of the century. And these themes carry strong resonance in public discourse today. Think of the current proposals for outlawing the sale of all ivory in continued attempts to save the endangered species of the elephant. Slavery has changed its methods since the 19th century, but abuse of the labor market and the appalling trafficking of people remain serious problems of our time. African discovery is not exactly what it was 120 years ago, but characters such as Livingstone and Stanley still catch the popular imagination and give rise to their modern equivalents, such as Tim Butcher's remarkable Congo journey narrated in Blood River. As for the scramble, need I say anything about ongoing debates involving the effects of the colonial presence and so on? Those of you who are here for the last hour heard Robert Gildea and his questioners do this in a very lively form just now. As you shall see, Tipu Tip's career was closely linked with all these themes, and what makes him additionally a great subject for a biography is that, uniquely among his Arab-African contemporaries, he wrote memoirs, which I'm going to refer to as the Maisha, meaning the life, the first word of the title in Swahili. Thus, we have his own voice, his own account, which, though written towards the end of his life, tallies extraordinarily well with episodes involving him which were carefully recorded by European explorers and others. I should perhaps tidy away the question of his name. He was born Hamad bin Muhammad al-Murjabi, a thoroughly Omani name. His looks show that he had plenty of local African blood, although his mother was also Arab. But he always and consistently considered himself an Arab. Like many Arabs in East Africa at that time, he was given a nickname. The nickname Tipu Tip may have originated in a nervous twitch or a habit of blinking, which several observers recorded in him. He himself preferred to attribute it to the rapid fire of his men's guns, tip, 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 onomatopoeically. How come this Arab presence? Arabs from Oman have been traveling and trading in the East African coast since the early days of Islam. For about 150 years, from 1500 to about 1650, the Arab presence was reduced because of Portuguese occupation. But gradually, the Portuguese themselves were displaced, and by 1700, the Omanis had established a chain of trading colonies down the coast. Interestingly, as John Wilkinson has shown by careful analysis of the clan and family names of those recorded in the area, these Arabs came not only from Muscat and the coastal regions, but in significant numbers from inland Oman. I'm talking about this part rather than Dhofar, the south, right here. It's rather Omani cane that they seem to have given me to use. So they intermarried locally, but descendants in the male line invariably referred to themselves as Arabs and generally spoke Arabic on formal occasions, even if Swahili was the language of every day. Tipu Tip's life fell neatly into the second half of the 19th century. He was born in Zanzibar in or soon before 1840 and died there in 1905. I'll talk a bit about his life, which may conveniently be divided up into five trading journeys, and then about those themes of the period. One of his trips was an absence from Zanzibar of 12 years and followed almost immediately by another of 3 years. So for about half his adult life, he was actually away from home. And his life and journeys give us an idea of how the Arab presence spread inland into what is now Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, northern Zambia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. By the time of Tippu Tip's birth, the Arabs are well established in Tabora. An important town where the trade routes crossed. And I was sitting at the back for the last talk, and I realized that it's actually quite difficult to see some of the detail. Anyway, Tabora, here is Dar es Salaam, which, by the way, was nothing at that time. Bagamoyo, important. Zanzibar, sister island of Pemba, Mombasa, and Lake Tanganyika. And these are the trade routes going across Africa. And Tabora, you can see, is right at the center of where these trade routes cross, going west to Tanganyika and across, and north past Lake Victoria. And the Arabs have begun to settle Ujiji, which is here on Lake Tanganyika. I'm getting plenty of exercise in this talk, so I have to come back here to give you the next slide. There's Ujiji at the time. And Tippu Tip was learning the trade of trading with his father. He crossed the lake and brought ivory tusks on the western shore of Lake Tanganyika. And in his early 20s, he began trading on his own account. And here you can see that he chose a more southerly route, going south of Lake Tanganyika and back. And he did this trip to Tabora on the way back because he collected so much ivory down here that he didn't have enough porters to carry it. And he knew that he could recruit porters. He used a mixture of slaves and freemen, but he was buying their labor here from Tabora, from the Unyamwezi, the people who traditionally made a habit of portering, collected a few porters here, it's about a couple of hundred miles, and then came back down again and took the ivory back to Bagamoyo. In this journey, Tippu Tip exhibited two traits which would reappear in his life and which I suppose gave him much of his success: firmness in disciplining his own men and a readiness to use violence in winning his way in commerce. The first was illustrated by an episode early in the journey when his men refused to obey the drum call to start the day's march. Tippu Tip rounded up and then tied up 200 of the men's elderly relatives. And when under this pressure the men returned to work, he had them yoked or chained together so they would not try mutinous tricks again. Second, the use of violence. In the region of Itawa, he entered a village, gave the chief and Sama generous gifts and retired to camp. The custom with many chiefs was that you didn't bargain to obtain what you wanted, but relied on exchange of gifts. Tippu Tip was obviously expecting to receive in return a decent presentation from the chief's known large stock of ivory. On re-entering the village the next day, Tippu Tip's men were attacked with bows and arrows, and under his orders retaliated with murderous gunfire, resulting in huge casualties. The outcome was that Tippu Tip was able to make off with pretty well all of this chief's huge stock of ivory, as well as quantities of copper from Katanga, which is just off this map to the west, and to the west of Kasembes. You can perhaps see Kasembes marked here. This is the custom they had of naming villages after the chief. Now, a brief interlude to say something about the caravans that carried trading goods across Africa at this time. Almost exclusively, they used human carriers and not pack animals or carts, for various reasons. Mainly, of course, the animals were subject to disease, especially infection by the tsetse fly, but other health hazards too. Occasionally, donkeys make an appearance, but surprisingly seldom. When Livingstone grew too weak to walk, his porters carried them themselves on a litter. Once and once only, when weakened by dysentery, Tippu Tip reports himself carried on a donkey. I suspect that the paths, often only a foot wide, and river crossings, of which there were many, made pack animals less than effective. Here's Stanley's caravan during his trip in the book How I Found Livingstone. And you can see that this is a bit of a detail, but the donkey here has had to be unloaded, so men are carrying the donkey's load in order to cross the river. The men normally carried 70 pounds, about 32 kilograms, although Stanley reduced the load to 30 or 40 pounds for precious items such as scientific instruments. Progress was very slow. When Burton and Speke travelled to Ujiji in 1857, they averaged 5 miles a day, and Stanley, on his way to find Livingstone in 1871, thought he'd done very well to manage 6 1/4. Tippu-Tip, after this trip, returned to Zanzibar, sold his ivory, paid his debts, and the money he'd made from this journey gave him not only cash in hand, but ability to raise credit from the mainly Indian merchant bankers in order to finance his next journey. The sums were enormous. He was advanced goods to the value of Maria Theresa dollars, 50,000. This would have been around about £10,000 sterling at that time. And it would have been the mix of beads, lengths of cotton cloth, perhaps copper wire, all the goods you needed for bartering for food, paying hongo, which is the kind of tax you paid across someone's land, and exchanging for ivory along the way. The Maria Theresa dollar, by the way, was common currency in Zanzibar, along with Indian rupees, but had no value in the interior. In the Maisha, Tippu-Tip does not tell us much of his plans or intentions. He just gives us the bald narrative of events and sometimes of conversations. From the quantity of barter goods he assembled on this occasion, we can tell that he planned to go further west than had been explored before by all but a very small number of fellow Arabs. Here we've got another map. And again, I'm so sorry, this is going to be difficult to see at the back. Here you see Tippu-Tip's journeys, and the next one we're going to describe goes all the way south of Lake Tanganyika, round these lakes here, up here, and we're going to spend a lot of time between these two great rivers, the Lualaba and the Lumami. Here, Lake Victoria again, Lake Tanganyika, Lake Nyasa, Lake Malawi, down here. So he goes around the south of Lake Tanganyika to Nsamas and Kasembis, where he was before, and then west and north to the great river Lualaba, this one here. And early in his journey, his caravan suffered from cases of cholera, one of the epidemics which hit East Africa in the mid-19th century. This one, in 1869-70, was brilliantly described by a young Scottish doctor, James Christie, a missionary doctor in Zanzibar, who was also among the first to work out the method of transmission of the disease via contaminated water. Travelling north, Tippu-Tip crossed the Lualaba and moved into the area between that river and the Lomami to the west, and here he spent some time and may even have established some kind of administration, possibly exchanging taxes or tributes for provision of security. He had won power by a humorous trick, claiming that his grandfather had bought, as a slave, a captive woman from the family of the local chief, Kasongurushi, and that he was therefore one of the chief's kinsmen. When Tippu-Tip met him, Kasongurushi, here he is, was amazed that Tippu-Tip should have travelled so far to come home, as it were. He invested him with authority and also a considerable quantity of ivory. Tippu-Tip made the most of these marks of favour. Tippu-Tip was now not far, so now he's up in this area. He's not far from where fellow Arabs had come across from Ujiji, across Lake Tanganyika, and up in this direction, and he met up with some of his fellow Arabs at that point, which was quite useful because they had skills in mending guns, which his men rather needed. And he set up base in Nyangwe, which I've lost, right here, and Kasongo. These are both places which are going to reappear in our narrative. Remember them carefully. So this is the moment, because in late... he met up here with the explorer Verney Lovett Cameron, and late in 1876 he received Stanley, with whom he travelled for just over 2 months. And this is the moment when I have to spend a few minutes on the search for the source of the Nile. You probably know that this question was the great unsolved mystery of exploration in the mid-19th century. We came across Burton and Speke earlier. They had been the first Europeans to see Lake Tanganyika at Ujiji, and Speke had still had reached Lake Victoria's southern shore. They'd gone from here up to the south of Lake Victoria. Speke did, but Burton didn't. Livingstone, however, he thought that the Nile source lay much further south and west, and he set out. Oh, that's Verney Lovett Cameron, who I meant to mention just now. And Livingstone set out in 1866 from the coast east of Lake Nyasa, hoping to find a place of four fountains mentioned by early classical geographers, where two streams would flow north, viz. The Nile, and two south, that is, the Zambezi. And that's what Livingstone believed, I believe, until the day he died. Livingstone met up with Tippu-Tip in 1867, near Lake Nyasa, still believing that the Lualaba was going to turn northeast and flow either into Lake Albert or in some other way join the Nile in Equatoria, the southern province of Egypt. Tippu-Tip's next encounter with European explorers was with Cameron, whom we saw just then. He had started out leading an expedition to relieve Livingstone, but on finding that the great explorer had died, Cameron continued westwards, travelled with Tippu-Tip from the Lualaba to the Lomami, and then headed south and then west to become the first European to cross Africa from east to west. He ended up somewhere near present-day Luanda. But Tippu-Tip's most famous and dramatic collaboration was in 1876 with Stanley, and who was determined to, as he said, complete Livingstone's work, i.e. to identify the source of the Nile. And it's very exciting that we have here in the audience a great-grandson and I think a granddaughter and other relatives of Stanley. So you're very welcome. What a pleasure. Stanley suspected that Livingstone may have been wrong in believing that the Lualaba was the Nile, but he admired him too much to voice the suspicion openly. He met Tippu-Tip in Nyangwe, and they came to an agreement to travel together for a fixed period down the Lualaba. They travelled therefore downriver, down the Lualaba. Yeah, and that was roughly where they separated. And only a few weeks after they separated, in December of that year, Stanley felt the river turn northwest, not northeast, and heard it referred to as the Congo for the first time. Now we can see what actually happens. The river Lualaba is the Congo. Stanley travelled down to the Atlantic and to lasting fame. Tippu-Tip now spent 3 years in Kasongo before starting his journey to the coast under pressure from his creditors, who, of course, hadn't heard from him for a very long time, wondered what was going to happen to their money. He travelled very slowly because of the vast amount of ivory he had acquired and because he wanted to see his father and mother in Tabora. And Tabora also, in 1881 to 1882, he came across Belgians for the first time, people sent by Leopold II to see if the Upper Congo could be exploited from the east as well as from the west. This was the period of great expansion of Belgium, well, really Leopold's personal expansion in the Congo. So the idea was to see whether you could come at it from both sides, up the River Congo. Or develop trade that way, or continue the traditional trading routes across here to Bagamoyo. And this is where Tippu-Tip met up with these Belgians. They wanted to exploit his knowledge of the region and his help in building stations in the Upper Congo River. Tippu-Tip demurred, interestingly, suggesting that this was from loyalty to Sultan Barghash, who claimed suzerainty over the Arabs all the way to the Lomami. Tupoutip had not met Barakash, but had recently had correspondence with him and would see more of him on his return to Zanzibar. This was a crucial juncture in Tupoutip's life and indeed in the history of the region. We are in late 1882. Leopold has now engaged Stanley to build stations up the Congo. We think of him as an explorer, and of course he did these fantastic trips, and he was an extraordinary leader of exploratory expeditions. But he did spend 5 years from 1879 to 1984 working under contract, so to speak, working for Leopold in developing the stations up the Congo. Leopold is hoping that ivory and other products can be brought down the river to the Atlantic. Other Europeans, especially the British and the Germans, are showing an interest in developing their presence in East Africa. All of this is likely to threaten the interests of Barakash and the Arabs. There's definitely a page missing. I have to skip it. I'm very sorry about this. This is such a crucial part of the narrative that I can't afford to leave it out. Right. Here we are. It's just a recap. So we've got the interests of the Arabs threatened, or in their trading interests in just round Lake Tanganyika, west of Lake Tanganyika, as well as east. And this system of the Arab presence in this part of Africa that had been built up over the past 50 or 60 years, this had allowed the Arabs to trade through the East African ports and the Sultan to provide a measure of protection while earning income from taxation and customs dues. Barakash received Tupoutip and had in mind to offer him the post of wali, or deputy or governor, in Tabora. But as they spoke, he, Barakash, realized that the real threat, lay further west in Belgian expansionism west of Lake Tanganyika. And instead, he mandated Tupoutip to return quickly to Nyangwe on the River Lualaba. In about October 1883, Tupoutip set out, taking care on the way to confirm Arab loyalty to the Sultan and also to collect a substantial armed force. This was not so much a trading caravan with some gun-carrying men to protect it, which he'd done before, but more a show of force and a reminder of the Sultan's authority. He went for the first time to Kisangani, which is a little bit further down the Lualaba River, very near where he had left Stanley on the earlier expedition, and he used this as a base for ivory acquisition in areas north and east. And just opposite the village of Kisangani was a Belgian station constructed by Stanley, called Stanley Falls. This is because this was a place on the River Congo, Lualaba, Congo, whichever you call it, where the river, having gone long and low and flat, flowing very calmly, suddenly precipitately goes down into cataracts, which happens on several points on the Congo. Now, this brought the Arabs and the Belgians eyeball to eyeball. Barakash wanted to prevent Belgian occupation and control east of the Lualaba or upriver from Kisangani, while retaining Arab rights to have the choice of trading on the Congo or sending goods back to the east coast. And although Tupoutip and the Belgians signed what were called treaties aimed at defining spheres of influence, confrontation turned to hostility. And in an engagement that had arisen from a trivial cause, the Arabs forced the Belgians out of Stanley Falls. The commander of the station, a young Brit called Walter Dean, destroying it by fire as he left. And in this contemporary picture, you see Stanley Falls set on fire in the background and Dean being rescued from the river, and he did indeed escape. News of all this was just arriving in Zanzibar when Tupoutip got back there in late 1886. He found Sultan Barakash deeply depressed. For reasons we shall see later when considering the scramble, Barakash saw his mainland dominions melting away. He said to Tupoutip, Tupoutip records this, The Europeans want to take even Zanzibar from me. So how can I keep the mainland? Those who have died without having lived through everything that's happening now, they have been happier. We don't know whether Tipu Tip was planning to return to the interior. The decision was made for him by the arrival, the re-arrival in Zanzibar, of Stanley in February 1887, with a proposition to him to join in the extraordinary episode of the Emin Pasha relief expedition. This is, of course, worth a lecture or seminar on its own, and indeed much has been written about it. Ian Smith's book, Ian R. Smith, written in 1971, covers it very thoroughly. In short, Emin Pasha, you see his real name, Edward Karl Oscar Theodor Schnitzer, clearly of German origin. He had been appointed governor of Equatoria by the Khedive Ismail, the ruler of Egypt, and had been forced southwards by the Mahdi rebellion. These are the people, you will recall, who had killed Gordon of Khartoum in 1885. And Emin Pasha was thought by a number of Europeans to be needing relief. An expedition was got together, Stanley was appointed leader, and the decision was taken to reach Emin Pasha via the Congo. On the face of it, this was not such a bad idea, and certainly one which appealed to Leopold. So Emin Pasha is on the upper Nile here. This word is equatorial, for those who can't see it. So Emin Pasha is right about here on the Nile. Here's Lake Albert. Here's the Nile flowing out of Lake Victoria into Lake Albert and out again. And Leopold said, well, if you're going to do this expedition, why don't you do it from the Congo, i.e. up here? And this was not such a bad idea, as I say, on the face of it. Leopold had, of course, his own motives. He wanted to develop the connection between the Congo and the Nile and take over all this area so that the trading could increase across all those routes. However, what they didn't know at the time was the terrible terrain here, really thick, impenetrable jungle. Stanley came to Zanzibar. So why Zanzibar? He came to Zanzibar in February 87 for various reasons. Counterintuitively, if the expedition's route was going to start on the west coast of Africa, not the east. And he did it because, first of all, Stanley trusted the porters that he could recruit in Zanzibar. And he also knew that Tipu Tip was there, and Tipu Tip could help in both this, the recruitment of people, and in organizing the physical needs of the expedition, barter goods, guns, and ammunition. And third, he had a mission from Leopold to recruit Tipu Tip as governor of Stanley Falls. Stanley Falls is this guy. Leopold realized that with the authority and influence that Tipu Tip had over all the Arabs in the Upper Congo, his support or acquiescence would be needed for the expedition to get through. And in the longer term, Tipu Tip's presence as governor might also be of use in neutralizing Arab opposition to the Belgian presence. It's not quite so clear why Tipu Tip accepted the job, which carried a paltry salary of £30 a month. Perhaps he thought that from Stanley Falls, he could maintain the Arab-Belgian standoff while continue trading on his own account. Barkash actually encouraged him to consent, so he did. The expedition started off okay. They sailed around the Cape. Tipu Tip and his 90 men and not a few women on board, and they started up the Congo. And then it turned into a disaster. Many men were lost in the almost impenetrable jungle of the Ituri, this bit here. So they came up the river, left the Congo here, up, this is a river called the Aruwimi, came along here and struggled through to Lake Albert. All on foot. Terrible, terrible jungle. And also, when they did meet locals, the local Africans were very, very hostile. Why? Probably because other Arabs, we know that Tipu Tip, we don't know. We're pretty sure that Tipu Tip had not been there. But other Arabs had been there and probably used great violence against the local Africans in order to get ivory. So when these new people arrived, Stanley and his lot, in the expedition, the locals attacked as well, very viciously, poisoned arrows, poisoned traps in the ground. You couldn't see anything. It rained the whole time. I mean, morale was absolutely dreadful. It's brilliantly described, both by Stanley in his book and then again by Ian R. Smith. And when eventually they arrived, exhausted and in tatters, at Lake Albert, Emin Pasha, dressed in a smart white suit, said he didn't really need relieving at all. Anyway, Stanley said, "Well, you've got to come home now. Look, here we are." So they did. They came back following this route, a huge, huge convoy, because Emin Pasha's people refused to leave anything behind, and it was about 1,000 people long. Anyway, they came down here. Stanley did some quite useful exploring for the Royal Geographical Society in this area, so it wasn't entirely useless. They came back here and came back to Bagamoyo. It all had a slightly ludicrous ending, for after that, because they had a party when they got back to Bagamoyo. And we don't know quite why it was, whether Emin Pasha had too much to drink or what. But anyway, climbing up the stairs, he actually fell off them and cracked his skull. He survived, but it was not a good way to end the party. Tipu-Tip stayed clear of the latter stages of the expedition, remaining for a apparently prosperous couple of years in Kesangani or Stanley Falls before leaving for Zanzibar in mid-1890. The Belgian-Arab hostility of 1886 had indeed lapsed into an uncomfortable standoff and was more or less peaceful at that time. Tipu-Tip's journey home was delayed by an attack of dysentery. That was the time when he travelled on a donkey. He reached Zanzibar in late 1891. From his retirement on his estates in Zanzibar, Tipu-Tip could only watch the deteriorating political situation. Here's how things were in 1886, but bit by bit, the Arabs were forced out of the territories west of Lake Tanganyika. So this shaded area, a large area, you see, was the area of Arab influence up until this time, until 1886. And they were gradually forced out by the Belgians back to the shores of Lake Tanganyika, which then became it's the present-day boundary of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that effectively was the boundary of the Congo Free State, as Leopold called it. There was a series of engagements from 1892 onwards in which Tipu-Tip's own son Saif was killed, and by mid-1893, the eastern border of the Congo Free State had been extended to the shores of Lake Tanganyika. Tipu-Tip's closing years in Zanzibar were taken up partly by lawsuits. One of these was with Stanley, who sued him for breach of contract over Tipu-Tip's alleged failure to supply the number of men, guns, and ammunition to which he had agreed in February 1887. Stanley's accounts for the expedition were in deficit, and he hoped to recoup some of the losses. Tipu-Tip, by now thoroughly fed up with Stanley, submitted a counterclaim. The sponsors of the expedition decided they could do without a court case in distant Zanzibar, and they got Stanley to drop the case. It is to the other court case that we owe a big debt of gratitude. Tipu-Tip was being sued by a former trading companion, Mohammed bin Khalfan al-Barwani. His nickname was Rumaliza. And he claimed that Tipu-Tip had entered into a profit-sharing agreement with him years back, according to which he was owed a quarter of all Tipu-Tip's assets. Rumaliza had been born in a town that was by now under German control, and the case was heard in Dar es Salaam. Judgment was given against Tipu-Tip. His assets in the mainland were not enough to cover the amount owed, for which Rumaliza then sued in Zanzibar, where he was allowed a German consular representative in court with him. This consul was Heinrich Broder, who thus met Tipu-Tip and persuaded him to write or dictate the memoirs, which we now have in the Maisha. Broder also wrote his own account of Tipu-Tip's life, the first edition published before Tipu-Tip's death. Writing in the late 1890s, Broder says that Tipu-Tip attends untiringly to his numerous personal affairs and that his fortune still amounts to £50,000 in round figures and is very advantageously invested in stone houses and landed property. From another document, we know that Tipu-Tip was said to be the second largest clove plantation owner in the islands. He died from a cerebral hemorrhage in June 1905, and a friend of mine recently discovered his grave, which in Zanzibar. Both because of the span of his lifetime, but also because of his activities and character, Tipu-Tip's life provides a prism through which we can gain insights into the great themes which dominated East and Central Africa in the second half of the 19th century. I'll go back to ivory, slavery, discovery, and the scramble, and take slavery first. You will probably know that the East African slave route is of much greater antiquity than the transatlantic route. Let's take a few points of difference and comparison between these two routes. Transatlantic slave trading began roughly in the mid-16th century when the Spanish and Portuguese needed labor in their South American possessions. And it ended roughly in the 19th century after the Wilberforce Act of 1807, a later Act of 1833. The 1807 Act ended trade in slaves. 1833 ended slavery in British possessions and dominions. And there were other treaties made by the British, for example, with the Portuguese. The first reference to East African slave trading is in a document of the first century, a document called the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. There was a mutiny of African slaves in Mesopotamia in the 9th century. Ibn Battuta, the famous Arab historian, mentions them in his 14th century travels. And the trade probably peaked in the second and third quarters of the 19th century, when the throughput of the market in Zanzibar amounted to 15,000 to 20,000 slaves every year. The boats used for the eastern trade were, of course, much smaller than those used on the Atlantic. Arab dhows took only a few dozen slaves at most, transatlantic ships up to 300. Calculations of numbers on both routes is difficult, but educated guesses suggest that through the long period of East African slavery and the 300 years of Western, the total numbers were similar, about 12 million, though some think that the number may be as high as 20 million on each route. The differences? Well, while slaves taken to the Americas were mostly used on plantations, sugar, tobacco, cotton, those on the eastern route went to public works, pearling, armies, navies, and the majority probably into agriculture and domestic service, the latter including females who became concubines. Plantations of cloves and other spices became big business from the 1820s in Zanzibar and its sister island, Pemba, and also in the Mascarene Islands, now Réunion and Mauritius, and Madagascar. These plantations employed large numbers of slaves captured on the mainland, perhaps a quarter of those traded in Zanzibar. The East African slave trade was characterized by extreme violence. Most slaves were captured in intertribal or intervillage fighting and then sold by the African victors to Arab slavers. Later, as the Arabs moved further west across Lake Tanganyika into Upper Congo, there was a tendency for them to capture the slaves directly. The slaves were taken to the coast, to markets in Zanzibar and Mombasa and elsewhere, often in very cruel conditions. Images such as these, which are taken from the book recounting Livingstone's last journeys, played a huge part in Livingstone's campaign to get the British government to have the slave trade outlawed in East Africa. From there, those slaves who were not kept on local clove or spice plantations were shipped north, mainly to the Gulf and Persia, some to the Red Sea, and a few even to India. From Portuguese possessions further south on the coast, some were shipped to America. The British were prominent in bringing pressure to bear to end the trade, from relatively soon after the 1807 Act, pushed through Parliament by Wilberforce. Approaches were made to the great Sultan Said bin Sultan, Sultan of Muscat, who later moved his court to Zanzibar. And then a treaty was signed with him in 1822, prohibiting the sale of slaves from his dominions into any British or European possession. That, of course, included India, with the added provision that slaves could not be carried in ships east of a line from Cape Delgado to Diu Head. This is a little bit complex, but the idea of this, here is the line. and here is DU Head. So the idea was that this treaty gave the right to the British to seize and capture any ship south or east of this line. And the Sultan or the Omanis could trade only on the coastal side of the line. The line was later changed in 1839 to here to confine the legitimate trading area even more. That was with Said bin Sultan. And after his death, the Sultanate was split between Muscat and Zanzibar. And in 1873, after tortuous negotiations, which did not at first succeed, the British forced the sultans of both Muscat and Zanzibar, who were brothers, both sons of Said bin Sultan, to sign agreements by which the sultans would prohibit the trade and close the slave markets. Slavery itself did continue in Zanzibar, and the trade continued on land routes on the mainland. But it was eased out by further decrees in Zanzibar and then by regulations passed after the British declared Zanzibar a protectorate in 1890. To what extent is it justified to call Tipu Tip a slave trader? It was certainly not his primary business. That was in ivory. Early in his career, he remarks that his half-brother Muhammad bin Masud had been trading in slaves in areas further south on the routes past Lake Nyasa and had not been as successful as Tipu Tip had been with ivory. The description of Tipu Tip as a notorious slave trader needs some moderating. Of course, the ivory trade also involved cruelty and violence and had disastrous effects on the population of elephants, a trend that tragically continues to this day. The decline in numbers of elephants in the coastal regions was observable even in the 19th century, and British explorers of the time record that. There was growth in demand for ivory from Europe and North America, especially when machinery was invented to make items on a large scale, such as billiard balls, piano keys, and combs. In 1900, I find this difficult to believe, but I have checked the source of this. And what I'm told is that in 1900, it was estimated that 300,000 pianos were produced in America alone. So that's a lot of ivory, even though it's very thin. For the Arabs, it was often an easy trade. In many cases, villagers killed elephants for their meat and had no value for the tusks, which they sold cheaply to the traders. At other times, Tipu Tip found chiefs who had stored up the ivory, presumably waiting for a trader to turn up, and drove a harder bargain. Later, in the 1880s, on the Congo, Arab traders began to attack local villages and force the inhabitants to bring in and hand over ivory, though we have no firm evidence of Tipu Tip himself engaging in this kind of raiding. Caravans of freemen and slaves carried the product to the coast, and the Congo was also used as a trading route as the Belgians developed their stations on the river. I'm afraid you probably can't see this, but this text here says, "Wishing you a happy and joyous Christmas." Oh, this is a doorway in Zanzibar. I find it rather surprising. I owe some comments on the explorers and also on the scramble. Tipu Tip had more contact with European explorers than any other Arab of his generation. There are hints in the Maisha that his fellow Arabs couldn't understand why he should put himself out for the Europeans and that he was unusual in this respect. The answer may be that he believed the long-term future of the Arabs in East and Central Africa lay in having a modus vivendi with these new interlopers. In addition, he seems to have had an untypical curiosity about the outside world, which made him an interesting traveling and social companion for the explorers. Whatever the reason, the outcome is good for the historian. The explorers in particular, but also the colonial officials, kept careful diaries recording dates and places of where they were and with whom, and this enables us to cross-check the account in Tipu Tip's Maisha. Several of the great names appear in his narrative. We've seen how he helped Cameron, Stanley, and Livingstone. Other explorers are less known to posterity. This man was a German explorer who crossed Africa from the west and left us a description of his meeting with Tipu Tip in 1882. Becker, a Belgian colonial official, but also explorer. Also, Oscar Lentz, an Austrian who was helped by Tipu Tip on the Lualaba in May 1886. Finally, a few words about the scramble, or at least that part of it which concerned Tipu Tip. We have seen the growth of European interest in the region through the 1880s, driven by the wish to protect and advance imperial interests, and also, though this was sometimes a pretext, to secure abolition of slavery and the munitions trade. The tide turned in 1885 when a German adventurer called Karl Peters signed treaties with chiefs in the hinterland between the coast and Lake Tanganyika, offering German protection. Up to this point, the British had been content to follow the policy of what was then called informal empire, a phrase which means something a little bit different from what Robert Gildea was talking about earlier this afternoon. And this idea here was mainly an idea of John Kirk, which left, the idea was that you leave sovereignty to the Sultan by exert very strong influence on all his policies. German activities gave rise to a delimitation commission under which British, German, and French representatives fixed the boundaries of the Sultan. The outcome left Barkhash with a 10-mile coastal strip, and the rest, as you see, German East Africa, which is now mainly Tanzania, Portuguese East Africa, and British East Africa, which became Kenya. So the Arabs were forced out of their area of influence, and 4 years later, negotiations between London and Berlin resulted in an agreement of July 1890, which gave Britain a protectorate over Zanzibar and certain other concessions, while Germany received assurances over Namibia, and also, surprisingly, the island of Heligoland off the mouth of the River Elbe. The Sultan, who is now Ali bin Said, a half-brother of Barghash, had to acquiesce, and he later sold that coastal strip to the Germans to £200,000. It's time to conclude. Tipu-Tip's era was one of a massive change in East and Central Africa. When he was born, elephants roamed in the coastal plains, Arabs traded up to Lake Tanganyika, Sultan Said ruled in Muscat and Zanzibar, and no European had seen Lake Tanganyika or been more than a few miles up the Congo. When Tipu-Tip died, elephants were in decline, the slave trade was ending, and the whole region in which he operated had been divided up among the colonial powers, even including Zanzibar. Tipu-Tip may have been baffled as to how this had come about, the result of different concepts of rule and authority. While the Europeans brought notions of sovereignty, in which control was linked to territory, the Arabs retained a model based on personal loyalty. Tipu-Tip's loyalty was always to the Sultan, even when a long way distant. Similarly, his own authority was maintained through a network of personal connections, not ownership of land. This authority and influence with his fellow Arabs declined in his later years, but at its height was considerable, based on respect for his force of character and the wealth he had gained. Looking back, with a perspective that abhors the slave trade and the damage done by the world's fascination with ivory, we don't have the same admiration for him as did his contemporaries. But I should still like to have met him. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.